It's Tuesday, October 29, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Hawaii is back in the headlines on the issue of same-sex marriage. Back, I say, because back in the year 1996, it was the state of Hawaii, then poised to adopt civil unions, that led to the United States Congress and the then President of the United States, Bill Clinton, putting into law the Defense of Marriage Act, the very national act that established marriage as the union of a man and a woman that was invalidated by the United States Supreme Court just earlier this summer in June. Now Hawaii's back. As USA Today reports, Hawaii may become the 15th state to legalize same-sex marriage. Time magazine reports that Democratic Governor Neil Abercrombie has called the session after State House and Senate members were unable to pass the same-sex marriage bill with the two-thirds support required. This is an interesting story because, of course, it's not only about how Hawaii has changed, but how America has changed. Back in 1996, when Hawaii first contemplated something like gay marriage, the rest of the country knew nothing of it, legally or, for that matter, even conceptually. And Hawaii then started a national conversation and then largely left the headlines. The Defense of Marriage Act, passed by Congress by overwhelming majorities in both houses in 1996, was signed into law by then-President Bill Clinton, and it was considered to be, at that point, a definitional statement, a definitive statement, a statement that would stand for time. And yet, of course, it hardly stood. It didn't even stand, as it turned out, for 20 years. In the year 2013, the United States Supreme Court, by a 5-4 majority, declared that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. That was a thought that was hardly on the minds of Americans in 1996. And yet, that tells us a great deal about how moral change takes place. In the course here of just a matter of a few years, 17 years, America changed phenomenally, overwhelmingly on this issue. It is not the case now that all Americans support same-sex marriage. As a matter of fact, the most credible research indicates that just under half of Americans still believe that there should be no legal same-sex marriage. But the progress toward same-sex marriage reminds us that it isn't a moral majority who makes these decisions about moral change. It is a minority. A minority that often single-mindedly presses a moral agenda for a moral revolution. It generally takes a long period of time. On the issue of same-sex marriage and the normalization of homosexuality, we're talking about a very short amount of time, a time unprecedented in human history in terms of the velocity of this change. As the San Francisco Chronicle reports, Governor Abercrombie called the special session in his belief that by calling it, he's going to be able to get this legislation accomplished. That's what happened as an analogy in the state of Texas, where you'll recall just a matter of months ago, the governor of that state, Rick Perry, called a special session in order to resolve the issue of abortion in that state. And yet, yesterday's news also brought the fact that a legal challenge to that action has upended the legislature's decision and eventually the law signed into effect by the governor in that state. We're looking here at how moral issues continue to be issues of debate even after the Supreme Court rules and even after legislation, landmark legislation, is passed. What we're looking at in this equation is that America is now divided not only into two major moral cohorts, but several. We're looking at the reality that there are people whose moral worldviews now bear little resemblance to people who live on the same street, who inhabit the same community, who go to the same school. Observers of the situation in Hawaii expect that Hawaii will indeed become the 15th state to legalize same-sex marriage. It will be the next if this takes place. It will almost certainly not be the last. But what we see here is history circling back to Hawaii as ground zero for this situation, this issue, right now. And what we're looking at is the fact that in less than 20 years, a moral revolution has taken place, not only in Hawaii, but in the larger nation, and not only in America, but in what used to be called Western civilization, where the issue of a moral revolution in sexuality is now a matter of not where it will start, but where it will end, if there is indeed any end in sight. I mentioned last week the controversy that centers on the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Secularists led by Mikey Weinstein, an advocate and activist, had called for the language in the honor code of the Air Force Academy to drop the language, "So help me God." As Time magazine reports, the Academy's original honor code dates back to 1959, and it reads, quote, "We will not lie, steal, or cheat, nor tolerate among us anyone who does." In 1984, in response to a widespread cheating scandal at the Academy, the language was added, "We will not lie, steal, or cheat, nor tolerate among us anyone who does. Furthermore, I resolve to do my duty and to live honorably, so help me God." As time goes on to explain, the phrase "so help me God" was tacked on, quote, to add more seriousness to the oath. That's according to a former faculty member, and that's why last week I pointed out that the nature of a human oath of this form, even as is revealed in the scripture, has to do with the fact that when we say "so help me God," we are invoking a witness greater than ourselves as a surety, as an assurance for the covenant or the oath that is made. In the book of Hebrews, the writer tells us that God takes an oath in his own name because there is no name higher than his that he can invoke. But when human beings take an oath, we say, "so help me God," in order to make very clear that we know that God is a witness to the pledge we have made. The situation in the Air Force Academy is that students are now given the option. This was the middle proposal. Mikey Weinstein and those who were affiliated with him wanted the phrase, "so help me God," to be dropped absolutely. And yet what the Air Force Academy has done through the decision of its superintendent is to decide that it is now optional. So students can now say as an option as they take this oath, "I know someone's watching me and someone greater than myself is a witness to this oath." Others will simply say, "so help me." They won't be saying that in those words, but they'll be saying that in effect. Oh, and by the way, let's recall the fact that in 1984, this language was put in place because the honor code without this language was perceived to be too weak. Now they're returning to the very language adopted in 1959 that didn't prevent the scandal in 1984. We don't believe necessarily that any given words in themselves will avoid a scandal, but removing those words indicates that there is now the decision to say there is no divine witness necessary to the giving or taking of this oath. Internationally, the big headlines in recent days have to do with spying scandals, and at the center of that scandal is nothing other than the government of the United States of America. In the wake of the scandal over the NSA's surveillance of Americans and their communications comes the reality, or at least the claim, from now many centers of government in Western Europe that America has been spying on its friends. And there is a frenzy of outrage and concern registered in governments all over the world. What we're looking at here is a very interesting dynamic. Governments have always spied on one another. Has the United States gone outside of the lines here? It may well have done so, but of course, what may actually be in play here is that the public revelation of these realities means that there is now an embarrassment that isn't actually anything that's new, but is what leaders of these foreign governments have to act as a sudden revelation in order to maintain their own credibility. The reality here is that almost everyone in terms of the international world spies on one another. Friends spy on enemies. Friends spy on friends. And just about everyone spies on just about everyone. The only limits being the limits of the actual technologies involved. Given the reality of electronic surveillance, it turns out that there are very few technological limits. Some are now claiming that for a length of about 10 years, the United States government has been listening in on the cell phone conversations of Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. Similar complaints have come from Brazil and elsewhere. In the Financial Times, published not in the United States, but in London, Joseph Joffe writes, quote, "Gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail." He was quoting there Henry Stimson, who was the United States Secretary of State. He wrote that in 1929 as he closed down his department's code-cracking outfit. He claimed that it wasn't necessary. Of course, just when World War II got restarted again, it turned out that gentlemen did read other gentlemen's mail. Even during World War II, as the United States and Great Britain were the closest of allies, they were spying on each other. And there is adequate information now available to us under the Freedom of Information Act to make very clear that both sides spied on one another and were fully aware of the spying going on. As a matter of fact, Winston Churchill very famously had a personal private toilet established in what were known as the Cabinet War Rooms. He would hide himself away in that particular room in order to avoid being spied upon, as it turned out, by his own people. When they took the Cabinet War Rooms apart, that portion of it, after the war, they discovered that the toilet was attached to nothing. Instead, there was a telephone there. The British Prime Minister was retreating from his own staff to be able to call the President of the United States, and he wanted to speak in confidence, afraid that his own people were spying on him. About these issues, by the way, Winston Churchill said a famous line. He said that truth is so valuable and vulnerable that it must be guarded by a bodyguard of lies. In the world of international relations, international espionage is always close at hand. How will this come down? Well, one of the very interesting things to watch is the fact that those who are complaining about this kind of espionage are tempering their complaints very carefully, putting themselves in a position where they will not be overwhelmingly embarrassed if it turns out they were spying on the very people they're complaining about spying on them. Perhaps one of the most interesting aspects of all of this is found in an editorial also published in the Financial Times. It ran on October the 25th, that's Friday of last week. The editors of the Financial Times, one of the most respected and thoughtful newspapers in the world, say that what this underlines is the need for international rules. New international rules on spying, not against enemies, but against friends. Spying in the light of all kinds of new information technologies and surveillance opportunities. It's a very interesting editorial, and it suggests that there is a new set of rules now needed. But of course, as we understand it from a Christian worldview perspective, when we understand that a nation finds that its interest is under threat, you just have to wonder, how long will these rules stay in effect? How long will governments honor these rules when they have the opportunity not only to listen in on their enemies, but even on their friends? Interestingly, in this editorial, the writers cite Joseph Heller's novel Catch-22, in which that author said the authorities have a right to do anything we can't stop them from doing. Christians come back and understand that this is the very reason why we should understand that political states and governments can often gain too much power, because governments will do anything they can get away with doing unless they are stopped. That isn't something that originates with Joseph Heller. That was something that was stated very clearly by the founding fathers of the United States of America. And furthermore, it didn't start with them either. It goes all the way back to the earliest discussions of politics amongst fallen human beings, who understand that when you form a government, the government can serve the people, but the very same government can prey on the people. The government can listen in on the conversations of its enemies, but it may also listen in on the conversations of its friends, and as we discovered here in the United States, even of its own citizens. From a Christian worldview perspective, looking at this, we have to understand that this goes right back to the human nature of governments doing whatever they can get away with doing, which we need to understand is also the story of individuals. We will get away, in many cases, whatever we can get away with. That's why we need a structure of law. That's why we should be very thankful for the binding power and authority of conscience. That's why we should be very thankful for the moral authorities that God puts in our lives, starting with our parents and then extending to law enforcement and an entire regime of government. But that's also where we understand that the government itself is also made of human beings, and made up of human beings, sinners all. We have to only expect that governments will sin also, which is why governments have to listen in on other governments and check their power. And that's why citizens also have to always understand that a government left unchecked is a tyranny just waiting to happen. Shifting to the issue of how we think and why we often think in such a faulty way, I want to turn to a new book out by Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Federal Reserve Bank. This new book, entitled The Map and the Territory, Risk, Human Nature, and the Future of Forecasting, deals with the fact that since the financial downturn of 2008, we discovered that economists have often been given to faulty thinking that has led to disastrous results. What took place in 2008 and thereafter was exactly the opposite of what many economists, if not most, had predicted. There turned out to be a lot of faulty thinking going on. As Benjamin Applebaum writes in his review of the book in the New York Times, quote, "The mistake is that forecasters treated humans as rational decision makers, a functional fiction that no longer seems functional." What he's saying here is that economists thought the human beings would act according to rational choice. We would think as consumers, as producers, as CEOs of industries, as legislators and as presidents. We would think in ways that would make rational sense, but we often don't think that way. And that's why he explains the entire economy was turned upside down. We had too much confidence in the economy when it didn't deserve it, and then too little confidence in the economy when we undermined it. Now, why would we think that way? Alan Greenspan's book is just an indication of the fact that often human beings are left scratching their heads wondering, why do we think as we think in ways that are so obviously wrong? Well, in retrospect, you can correct some thinking, but you can't solve the problem of faulty human thinking. That's something that was also raised by another economist in the pages of the New York Times in an article entitled, Why We Make Bad Decisions. A similar witness comes in the form of Norina Hertz, a professor of economics at University College in London. She writes about why we make bad decisions, quote, "It is also crucial to ask probing questions, not only of the experts, but of ourselves. This is because we bring into our decision-making process flaws and errors of our own. All of us show bias when it comes to what information we take in. We typically focus on anything that agrees with the outcome we want. We need," she says, "to be aware of our natural-born optimism, for that harms good decision-making, too," end quote. This is a very interesting series of articles. And after all, there's a great deal of testimony to the fact that human beings tend to make very bad decisions based upon very faulty thinking. And why is that so? This is where Christians need to remember that the fall had intellectual consequences. Theologians refer to these as the noetic effects of the fall, noetic referring to the process whereby human beings think. The fall had consequences on our thinking. If the fall had not taken place, our memory would be constant. We wouldn't forget things. If the fall had not taken place, we would think entirely in ways that are true and rational. Once sin enters into human experience, it messes up our rationality. We now have a prejudice based in our sinfulness to want certain things to be true even when they're not true, or to want things not to be true when they are true. What you have from these witnesses, Alan Greenspan, and in this case, the economist Norina Hertz, is the fact that human beings think in ways we already know don't work. But we're so accustomed and addicted to these patterns of thinking, we persist in them anyway. We are prejudiced. We want to think certain things in spite of the evidence or given the lack of evidence. We want to believe certain things to be true, and we will, as Norina Hertz says, privilege the evidence that argues for our position and will simply disregard the evidence that argues against our position. This just goes to prove what one influential philosopher said years ago. We are human, all too human, and that humanity affects the way we think. It's easy for parents looking at children to say, how can you remember those multiplication tables one day and forget them the next? It's because that's the way the fallen human intelligence works. And it works on us too, parents. We need to recognize that it works at all ages and for all people at all times. We are intellectually faulty. We're made in the image of God, and thus we have this enormous capacity of intelligence. But oh, how we know that it often fails us. Here you have economists scratching their heads wondering, how did we miss so much? Norina Hertz comes along and says, well, it turns out it's not only the experts who have faulty thinking, but the people they're observing as well. This is the human condition, east of Eden. And our prejudices, our lack of rationality, our wishful thinking and our unfounded optimism, our selective use of evidence, and for that matter, our bias and just hoping for certain things to be true. This simply is evidence of the fact that the fall had its consequences not only on our bodies, but also on our brains. Our intelligence, too, is a testimony to a need for redemption. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.